We're back here on 560 WQAM. Little Jane's Addiction there. Greg Likens here alongside Adam Beasley. Dan Day on the other side of the glass. Playing all the hits for us tonight. This has been good, man. We're going down memory lane with some of these songs.
Favorite band of all time, Jane's Addiction, Perry Farrell.
There we go. The only thing we've missed tonight, no pressure, Dan. We just have not heard any Cher. So I know.
Yeah,
that,
come on.
I know everybody's disappointed.
We get three of Incubus, but not one of the greatest icons in music history.
She's still in great shape, right? You saw her
Holy
in person.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
72, washboard abs. She was wearing a see-through, like, fishnet outfit. 72 years old.
72 years old. That's why your dad wanted to see her. Now it all makes
sense.
Okay,
here's a funny story. So, God bless him, my dad, not the most technologically adept guy, and sometimes he's a fish out of water and in situations he doesn't really know, and so you take him and put him into Las Vegas, and it's a bustling, big lot going on, so we go see Cher. And we have electronic tickets, they're on my phone, and we're sitting like six rows from the top. I mean, I didn't spring for the good ones, all right?
The king of StubHub.
Correct.
Yeah.
But it's like a 5,000 seat venue, so there's no bad seat. And so I look at the section, I look at the rows, like, okay, our seats are there. I point to where our seats are. And it's like, I'll go get us some beers. So I go out and wait in line. It's a long line because it's like 10 minutes before the show starts. And he comes out totally distraught, sweating. He's having basically a panic attack. Apparently, he had a bit of a run-in because he was in the wrong seat. I didn't show him exactly what seat number.
You just said, yeah, we're over there.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
And some opinionated lady, we'll just say that much, came up and tried to make him leave, and he stood his ground because he thought it was his seats. And so they got the cops involved. So the police removed my 72-year-old father from his seat.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and so I looked at the ticket. It was like, yeah, we were like three seats down. I was like, how was I supposed to know that? I was like, okay, calm down. So we get our beers, we go back in, and we're sitting like two seats down from where the woman that got him tossed was. So it's uncomfortable to begin with.
How awkward was that?
Yeah, and so I'm already like, okay, just deep breaths. And then he starts taking pictures of the show with the flash on.
Oh, geez.
After the third one, I just grabbed the phone, turn off the flash, and hand it back to him. So... He had patience with me when I was a child. I'm having patience with him while he's a grown-up.
You take him to Cher. He gets kicked out of your seats.
Correct.
Get back into the seats. Now, do they allow photography?
I didn't ask.
Okay.
He certainly didn't ask.
No. Oh, my goodness. But with the flash on, it's dark in there.
Yeah, it's a...
Okay. Yeah, so the woman who got him kicked out sees that as well, and I'm sure there's just tension. And...
Yeah, it was fun.
Oh, man. Sounds like a fun time in Las Vegas, huh?
Just a couple of Beasleys on the strip.
You're like, give me some more beer, right?
Yeah, right.
Let me get through this. All right, Bees. I want to touch on this series between the Warriors and the Rockets. Certainly, most people know it's a rematch of last year's Western Conference Finals. This year, they're meeting in the Western Conference Semifinals. The Warriors won by 4 points in Game 1. And afterwards, there was this controversy about the officials, right? Mm-hmm. And so the NBA also complicates things because it releases its two-minute report, and then it'll tell you what calls they got right, which calls they got wrong, and then it really doesn't do anybody any good, right? Because then we're just...
It just angers people.
They're admitting mistakes. Sometimes they're admitting that they were right, but overall, you're right. It riles up people, and they get worked up about it. And then this on top of the fact that the Rockets also, it's now been reported, put together a wide-ranging and very thorough report that they sent to the league office about last year's Game 7 and how the referees, over the course of that series, but specifically that game, basically screwed them out of winning mm-hmm. the game and potentially winning the NBA Finals if you connect the dots. So there was tension on both sides. The Warriors have been notorious all season long, letting the referees get into their heads.
Mm-hmm.
The Rockets the same way, and it was on display on Sunday afternoon. And quite frankly, from a fan's perspective, this has been a series I've been waiting for all year long, but it's a real turnoff to see every time both teams, there's a call one way or the other.
Right.
These guys are complaining.
At some point, shut up and play.
Yeah, so boisterously,
yeah.
So disrespectfully towards the officials, and it's gotten really out of hand in my opinion. All of that is the backdrop to then what we learned this morning. And so I learned more about NBA officials and the way they're assigned today than I had known ever before in my life. So apparently for the first four games of this round of the playoffs, the NBA has indicated to their officials which games they're going to be refereeing. And so it just so happened game two tonight is going to be refereed by Scott Foster, who is the most reviled ref by the Houston Rockets, among other teams, in the history of the game. And so he's a 25-year NBA veteran. He hasn't worked a Rockets game since James Harden publicly criticized him after fouling out of Houston's February 21st loss to the Los Angeles Lakers. Harden was fined $25,000 the next day, but he declared that Foster should never again be assigned any more Rockets games because of personal issues between Foster and the Rockets. And Harden said at the time that he's just rude and arrogant while interacting with players. He says, for sure it's personal, for sure. I don't think he should be even able to officiate our games anymore, honestly. So that happened in February. Haven't seen him since, and now he's going to be official tonight in this game. And, of course, this already on top of the bad feelings from game one.
Right.
So I know that the NBA decides this in advance. But it's also, Bees, this is arguably the most important series in the playoffs this year.
Sure.
And so even though it's decided in advance, and even though the best referees, based on watching them through the 82-game regular season, get the reward of then officiating in the playoffs, it's like, why would you have this? Even because you know the Rockets are going to use this as an excuse built in if things don't work out for them. Why would you even allow this to happen?
You shouldn't, because if nothing else, Foster might go the other way to prove that he is not does not have it out for the Rockets.
Right, yeah, it could go the other way.
Yeah, so there's no way that his judgment has not already been affected by the external circumstances. He is not, there is no chance, I don't care how impartial he is, there's no way he can call a perfect game or as close to a perfect game as possible because he's going to have this in his head. So the league should have stepped in. They should have assigned him another series. They should have sent him somewhere else. There's three other series going on right now.
He could be in Milwaukee right now.
Correct. And it would have been just fine. But if some calls go against the Rockets tonight, it's going to get ugly fast. Now, I watched most of the second half. I didn't see much of the first half of that game. But I guess the really egregious misses were in the first half.
Yes.
And that got the Rockets just totally mind bleeped, right? They were totally off their game, and then they started jumping into players, which should not be fouls. Okay, if I know you get a landing spot, but if you jump 2.5 feet beyond where your launch spot is, that's not a foul. It can't be. But I can understand their frustration because they felt like they had gotten screwed in the last series, and they were getting screwed again that night.
Yeah, and you know what? During the regular season, in fairness to them, they've been calling those fouls. Mm-hmm. Where if the defender jumps into your landing position,
that's one thing. If they jump into yours, but if you jump into theirs, that should not be a foul.
Well, that's why late in the game, I'm completely with you. The Rockets were trying to initiate the contact and
throwing out your legs and
essentially
and all that.
Acting and really trying to trick the referees, which I don't care for. In the first half, though, like there were legitimate fouls that weren't called. Mm-hmm. And so that's where there's an issue. Now, just more information about Scott Foster and the Rockets. According to ESPN Stats and Information, he issued 18 fouls, personal or technical, in the February 21st game, 12 of them against the Rockets, 6 against the Lakers. 7 of the fouls against the Rockets, who in that game blew a 19-point lead in the second half, occurred in the fourth quarter. Houston did not attempt a free throw in the final 20 minutes of the game compared to 17 free throws for the Lakers.
And they live on the line.
Span.
That is a team that lives on the line.
How about this? Taking it a step further, James Harden has played 265 games in the past 3 seasons, including the postseason. He has fouled out in 4 games over that time. 3 of them were officiated by Scott Foster. So all of this is now going to come to a head tonight, starting at around 10:30.
Even if he doesn't have a vendetta against them, he is affecting the game by being the referee because the Rockets absolutely believe it. They don't think they're going to get a fair shake. They're going to alter how they approach the game. This is a mistake by Silver by having him ref this game.
Big time. And I hope that they can try to compartmentalize this and actually just go out and play basketball.
Well, they got to win tonight.
Well, that's the thing.
If they lose tonight, they're not winning the series.
It's going to be very difficult. I don't know if I'd go that far. But
they're going to win 4 out of 5?
It'll be difficult. Yeah. But tonight, yeah, I agree. Tonight is a vital, vital game for the Houston Rockets. So they need to just go out and play basketball. And I hope they concentrate on that. Let's take a quick timeout, Bees. We're going to come back. I do want to touch, we don't talk a lot of Marlins baseball, but there was a significant move made today. And it's significant not just because of the way the roster is currently constructed, but also big picture based on how they've constructed this roster with one of the major moves to start the Derek Jeter era. We'll tell you about that next here on QAM.
Radio.com.
Oh man, I could just envision Adam Beasley and his dad pounding beers at the Cher concert.
Cops getting involved.
It was
what a wild night.
A night to remember.
No matter how hard I try.
Yeah.
I believe it.
I may or may not have been dancing at this point. Of course, this is the finale, right? This is how she closes out the show.
I hate to say it, I was bobbing my head just now.
It's like, a good jam.
The song is catchy.
And keep in mind, she was old then, and that was 20 years ago.
She was like 52 when she came over this, right?
Correct.
You say she's 72
She's
now?
72 years old now.
Yeah, this song's 20 years old.
Her, when she took the stage. Oh, God, I need to listen a little more. When she took the stage, she shouted out, "What is your granny doing tonight?" And it's not that. It was definitely not that.
Oh, man.
The
there we go.
The fishnet bodysuit.
At 72 years
old. At 72 years old.
And your dad making sure he documents it by taking pictures.
Well-lit pictures, by the way.
Yep. No, you know, we're talking about Game of Thrones, hard to see some of the battle scenes. Your dad could see those pictures of Cher. He had that flash working.
Whew.
All right, there you go. Man, it's all come full circle. That's Adam Beasley.
Dan, thanks for that, by the way. That was the highlight of the night.
Dan Day literally playing all the hits tonight.
Trying to do it. Making the moves, man.
We are going to take you up until 10 o'clock, and we've been getting a lot of text messages throughout the evening, which we appreciate. Kendall Toyota, West Kendall Toyota, text line 56022. I did want to mention this briefly. So with the Miami Marlins, when you look at what they did in the first offseason of Derek Jeter taking over, you know, obviously they trade Giancarlo Stanton. They get rid of Marcell Ozuna. They get rid of D. Gordon. And then the other name that was traded was Christian Yelich.
He was pretty good.
And Christian Yelich, in addition, you know, obviously he just won an MVP award. He's off to an unbelievable start to this season as well. But that was the one guy where you could make the argument that they had already had him under contract. And I think his contract average over the years was like $10 million mm-hmm. on average, which by baseball standards is very affordable for the production that he brings.
What do we say? I think we discussed this before. Basically $5 million per war. Per win over
right.
a replacement.
Mm-hmm.
So he's way better than two wins over a replacement. He's probably four or five. He's an MVP of the league.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, that was the one guy that, while I've talked to folks around the Marlins who said, well, he just didn't want to be here after the other moves mm-hmm. were made, so they needed to move on. They felt that was the case. But still, that was one where, Stanton's contract was so enormous. Like, you got to move on from that. Ozuna was about to try to get paid. D. Gordon, the whole thing. Yelich is the one guy that really upset me. It's like they could have kept him around. Well, anyway, the key piece in the trade on the other side
Uh-oh.
Coming to Miami
Uh-oh.
Was Lewis Brinson.
Uh-oh.
Such a nice story from Coral Springs.
Yes.
Marlins fan. He was like in a time in an offseason in which everybody wanted to get as far away from the Marlins as possible. He was the guy who was like, I love the Marlins.
Yeah.
I want to be here. And he was demoted today to AAA. And you look at his numbers, 136 games as a Marlin so far. He's batting 199, 11 home runs, 46 RBIs, no home runs, and just four RBIs in 27 games this season.
And that was the totality of what they got for Christian Yelich?
Well, there's a couple other pieces, but that was like the main attractive
Yeesh.
Point of that trade Yeesh. Was Lewis Brinson was the top prospect they were excited about.
I have been to two, if not three, Marlins games in the last 2 years, and I don't think I've seen him hit the ball at the infield once.
Mm.
He's not good.
No, he hasn't been good. He has, you know, he seemingly has some tools where he could be develop into a good player. What I can't figure out yet, because he's still a young guy, is if he just needs more time and seasoning or if he just isn't good enough.
Well, I mean, you said 100 and how many at-bats?
Well, 136 games.
136 games, so probably about 500 and some odd plate appearances. It's not that small of a sample, Greg.
No, it's not. Still a young guy, though. I'm just saying that I'm not sure if he was thrown into the major leagues too soon, right? I mean, on any other team, you could argue that he may have been developing behind the scenes in AAA, AA, whatever it might be, prior to getting to the big leagues.
So do you think, what, they give him a month down there and see what he does?
I think so. I'm just looking back, just to refresh my memory. The Marlins in that trade got Lewis Brinson, Monty Harrison, Isan Diaz, and Jordan Yamamoto. And okay. I haven't heard of those other three players.
No.
So Brinson was the crown jewel.
You're making
so
those names up, right? It's like Incubus songs. I mean, you're just saying random words and seeing if I believe them.
Yeah. So
megalomaniac.
Exactly.
So anyway, it's disappointing.
Well,
I mean,
the problem is this, is that for them, and I know, but they got a top half of the league farm system now, right? I mean,
it's much improved.
Really
that was
made
part
strides.
Of the goal, right?
But it's all for naught if guys like Brinson don't develop.
For sure. And this was supposed to be one of the guys that you would argue that if they were going to become a consistently good team,
mm-hmm.
and again, it's all relative, but a consistently good team sooner rather than later, he would have to be one that you hit on.
Sure.
And would be one of the young stars that you build around that not only would be a good player, but also you'd hope could bring back the fan base because he's a local guy and because he's got a nice personality. So somebody texts in and says, this is Cameron Maben part two. I don't know if I go that far. Cameron Maben has been a decent player, but your point is well taken. Because Cameron Maben and, you look at the deal for, I mean, I always go back to the Miguel Cabrera trade.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, Andrew Miller ended up being a good pitcher in Cleveland, but he wasn't good and in a relief role, but he wasn't good for the Marlins. Maben as well.
Well, Alfaro and Anderson and Brinson, those are the three guys that have to pop for them, right? I mean, those are really... They're supposed to be your cornerstones.
Right. And at some point, they just signed the prospects from Cuba. And mm-hmm. They're going to take a few years to get to
sure.
the big leagues. But yeah, the guys that are up now, yes.
Yes. Alfaro's 26. Anderson's 26. Brinson's 25. The next year or two, they should be hitting their prime. They mm-hmm. should really start to take off. And Alfaro's good. I mean, he's a good baseball player. But was Anderson batting, 240?
Yeah, he hasn't had their team has been really bad. They're 8-20.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a -58 run differential. So, the team isn't any good. And a lot of these players that you're saying, we were hoping would have maybe a breakout season, it hasn't happened so far.
I saw Alcantara look lights out. The one game I saw was incredible.
Some of these pitchers have some promise.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. So, I wanted to pass that along. It's disappointing, and I think that there is a certain segment of our audience in this region that really follows the Marlins, but I do think that all of the casual Marlins fans that, for South Florida sports in general, right, if the Panthers play well, if the Dolphins play well, if the Heat play well, if the Hurricanes play well, if the Marlins play well, then suddenly there's a segment of our South Florida audience / community that will jump on board.
Sure.
And they'll be there. And then for all those fan bases, some larger than others, you've got them, the fans will be there
thick or thin
at all times. But I think for the Marlins especially, you've got some of those diehards, but there's a lot of folks that are like, hey, I'll be back in 2 or 3 years.
I totally forget that they're in town, and I work in sports media. Like, I'll go weeks without thinking about the Miami Marlins. It's incredible. And it's no other – think of a comparable – baseball town that's just so completely irrelevant. The Rays, they're really good this year.
Yeah, the Rays have had a nice start to the season.
Even the Twins and Indians are up and down, but they've had ups, mm-hmm. right? The Twins have had some really good years. Obviously, the Indians went to the World Series. The Marlins might be the most irrelevant team in all of Major League Baseball because even people who live in the city have no idea who they are.
Well, not only that, but think about and I know that some of this you have to be a hardcore baseball fan, but if you go market to market, most sports fans can name the best players.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the most famous person right now associated with the Marlins?
Granderson, probably.
Right. But if you say just by, like, associated with the Marlins, people now associate them with Derek Jeter. Like,
oh, I see what you're
but
saying.
Nobody brings up any of the players.
Oh, of course not, no.
Right? Like, you know, most major league markets, if you ask a fan, they'll say, oh, well, we've got, you know, I'm not just talking about like the Mike Trouts or the Bryce Harpers in L.A. or Philadelphia now, but like whoever the best player is. Like, if you're talking, you know, in Cleveland, then they'll bring up Francisco Lindor.
Right.
Or they'll bring up, you know, any, you know, Trevor Bauer was pitching tonight.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of players that...
Houston's got a whole batch of them.
A bunch of their pitchers and Altuve and Correa and Bregman. Right, you go down the list, like every market, even some of the teams that maybe aren't as good, there's somebody there that you'd associate. Oh, yeah, I know at least that guy on the team.
Who's that for the Rangers?
For the Texas Rangers? Sinshu Chu, Nomar Mazara.
Elvis Andrews?
He's still there. I'm trying to think.
Watch Rangers games. So.
Yeah, but the Rangers are pretty anonymous, too.
Well, yeah, they're long gone, seemingly, the days of Josh Hamilton and them potentially contending for World Series. But, like, yeah, I mean, they've got some players that I think the locals would know.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the Marlins, it's like, hey, when I tell you the Marlins, who do you think of? And people are like, Derek Jeter. It's like Derek Jeter cannot impact the play on the field.
Well, he can.
It is funny, as you listen to sports radio, I have not heard anything about that's what's going on the field with the Marlins. I've heard about Derek Jeter and the quote-unquote game experience.
Yeah, that's...
Well, I mean, what can you talk about? It's just bad baseball. And it's not only bad baseball, but if you lose 9-8 every night, hey, at least they're fun to watch. They're losing 4-1. It's brutal.
Yeah, it hasn't been good. They're losing right now 6-4, bottom of the seventh inning to the Cleveland Indians.
You're making me excited for tomorrow night.
Well, you have your pick of good seats. I promise you that.
That's for sure. Hey, we had a lot of fun on the show this evening. When we come back, if you missed it, we had a great conversation with Troy Stradford, former Dolphins running back, former NFL Offensive Rookie of the Year in 1987. Talked to him about Josh Rosen, Christian Wilkins, and much more. That conversation coming up next year on QAM. Radio.com. Radio.com. Welcome back here to 560 WQAM. Greg Likens here with you alongside Adam Beasley from the Miami Herald. Appreciate everybody joining us here on this Tuesday night. Dan, the other side of the glass, will take you up until 10 o'clock this evening. We've got a lot to get into and certainly so much to talk about with Bees, considering the beach you cover right now. It's hot. We got Josh Rosen in town, certainly a six-player draft class headlined by Christian Wilkins, and now a very interesting and suddenly intriguing 2019 season around the corner. We're going to talk to Bees about that throughout the evening, and also right now we're going to go out to the Toyota of Hollywood hotline and welcome in Troy Stradford, postgame analyst on the Miami Dolphins Radio Network, former Dolphins running back. You can follow him on Twitter at Troy Stradford. I always like to bring up that he won the Offensive Rookie of the Year for the National Football League back in 87. Troy, a very good Tuesday night to you. How you doing?
I am doing wonderful, and a good evening, Tuesday evening to you two guys.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Troy, as always.
Always.
Let's start here, man. Let's start with the guy who's getting all the headlines right now. What has your reaction been to the Dolphins trading for and acquiring quarterback Josh Rosen?
I thought it was an outstanding move for the Miami Dolphins. Here we are leading up into the draft, and a lot of people from hearsay looking towards next year, and not saying that they're not continuing to do that, but all of a sudden, the Arizona Cardinals, they go out, they get a quarterback, Rosen becomes available, the Miami Dolphins, they end up giving a second-round draft pick for him, and now, all of a sudden, you have a guy who last year was highly recruited, regarded, coming into the league, and yes, he had his struggles. But if this thing works out for the Miami Dolphins this year, all of a sudden you're talking about a completely different picture at the quarterback position and moving forward for the team overall. Because, I mean, let's face it, if he comes here and he does very well in this system here, and I think the system is the key here, if it all turns around quickly, now you're talking about pointing your fingers in different directions and getting different assets and filling one huge hole, the major hole here for this football team. So I think it's an outstanding move by the Dolphins.
Troy, Adam Beasley here.
Hey,
what's up, man?
Always good.
When you watch him on tape, what's one thing that impresses you and one thing that concerns you?
I got to be honest. I haven't really watched him that much, so I can't sit here and say that. So I'm going all on hearsay, like what the Miami Dolphins are putting out there, what all the so-called experts are putting out there. I'm just looking forward to the guy getting a new clean slate where he can actually start over, because I've been trying to think back, and no, I didn't go and do the research, but I'm sitting there saying, okay, how many quarterbacks have been drafted in the first round, and then the very next year they are traded away? That doesn't happen often, if it has ever happened. So I'm sitting here saying, it's like the Miami Dolphins actually got two first-round draft picks. Now it's all up to Rosen and the system to work together and make him a productive quarterback here for the Dolphins.
Troy Stratford joining us here on 560 WQAM. All right, Troy, here is the question that I have for you.
Yes.
Do you think this offensive line is going to be good enough for us to get a fair evaluation of him in the 2019 season?
That's a million-dollar question right there, because across the board, you look at the Miami Dolphins offensive line, and yes, I like the number two pick, Michael Dieter. I mean, he just has a nasty attitude about him that you like in your offensive linemen. But overall, you look at it, and they've had their struggles. Going back to last season, I guess they ranked right below or right ahead of the Arizona Cardinals, so definitely need some work done there. I know this. Looking at the Patriots, and I really believe that a lot of what Flores is doing down here, of course, comes from everything he learned up there with the Patriots. And I'm not sitting here saying that the Patriots always had the best offensive lineman, and I know they had Tom Brady behind there who had the knack to get rid of the ball and, you know, avoid trouble. But I always thought that their technique of whatever they were doing kind of it compensated for the lack of talent in certain areas. And these guys become very good offensive linemen. So I'm thinking it all comes down to the technique. The one position in football that I always felt, that you didn't have to be talented was the offensive line. I thought you just had to be serviceable. And if the system, the scheme played out well as a unit, you got to stay healthy, yes, as a unit, you could be very productive as long as that quarterback has the know-it-all to actually get rid of the football, don't take stupid sacks, get rid of the football when you need to get rid of it and line up and beat them the next play. So I think it all works hand in hand. So I'm not sitting here looking for these outstanding offensive linemen. I'm banking more on the scheme that the Miami Dolphins are going to put together to make these guys work productively as a team together.
Yeah, and not only do they have an offensive line that's in flux, for the first time in recent memory, they've got a fullback. They picked up Chandler Cox in the seventh round. He might be the Dolphins' James Devlin. So to me, the personnel moves they've made are they say they insist they're not going to be the Patriots South, but they're kind of being the Patriots South. They're doing a lot of things that New England did. New England used James Devlin last year 35% of the time. If you had an offense this year with a kind of a hit-or-miss offensive line, a young quarterback, wouldn't a fullback and an extra tight end kind of be the smart play?
Absolutely, and when they made the pick there in the seventh round from Cox, I sit there and say, okay, that's a signal to me that they're going to be physical as well. They're going to bring a fullback in there, extra protection if needed, and then in short yardage situation, goal line situations, he's definitely going to come in handy as well. So the Miami Dolphins won't have to be spread out all the time or just a one-back set. So it actually signals to me that the Miami Dolphins are coming with more of a physical approach as well. And we all know, going back, and we have to do this, we have to always go back to where Flores comes from, and it's the Patriots. And the Patriots, as much as they throw the football, they'll run it down your throat. And they play that mismatch football, and I look forward to seeing that down here with the Miami Dolphins. So I like the addition of a fullback.
Yeah, they ran the ball 161 yards a game in the playoffs last year. Yes, Tom Brady is fantastic, but it's the balance and the ability to line up different ways. They want versatile players. Getting back to Rosen for a second, one thing that to operate this offense, you need to be a smart. And that's one area that I'm not concerned about Josh Rosen. We can talk about attitude all you want. We can talk about durability all you want. But there's no questioning that guy's intelligence. So my assumption is he's going to pick up this offense pretty quick, and there's no reason he shouldn't win this job.
Please, I'm in the same line as you. I like smart football players, and in addition to Rosen, we talk about Wilkins, the number one pick, you know, academic All-American, mm-hmm. I believe it was. You're just talking about smart football players, guys who are going to be where they're supposed to be. They understand the game. They understand the situation in the game. So when it comes to Rosen, yes, he has that background, that reputation of being a smart quarterback, and that will definitely aid him coming down here, picking up a new system. And I like the fact that he's still very young and the fact that he hasn't been molded into something already. You know, he's still wet clay, and they have the opportunity to mold him to what they want him to be. And smarts definitely helps along the way. So I kind of like it.
Troy Stratford, postgame analyst in the Miami Dolphins Radio Network. Of course, former Dolphins running back joining us here on 560 WQAM. All right, Troy, we've talked so much about Rosen. Bees and I were joking that it's kind of strange. You don't usually see the first-round pick get overshadowed in this matter, but Christian Wilkins indeed was that pick at number 13 overall. Really good player. By all accounts, a great person as well. Take us back to your Thursday night when the draft was going on. Did you like this pick, especially when you consider that Dwayne Haskins was still on the board? A lot of Dolphins fans thought the Dolphins may go quarterback there.
I'm thinking quarterback at that situation. Okay, the Miami Dolphins are going to pull the trigger. They're going to bring a quarterback in here, possibly Haskins from Ohio State. And I'm like, that wouldn't be a bad idea. Fan base would be happy. All of a sudden you could build around that young quarterback. But now, in hindsight, I'm sitting there saying, the Miami Dolphins already knew inside that building that they had an opportunity to go and get Rosen. And so they're sitting there saying, we're going to start on the defensive side. We're going to get arguably one of the best defensive players out there when it comes to Wilkins. And you can't tell me that. If you're a Dolphins fan, if you're a football fan, you just love how he almost took out Roger Goodell, right? That was confidence in a young man. You know, most guys, not saying that the other guys are not confident, but they walk up there, they shake hands, and you just see the enthusiasm in this young man coming up there, almost taking out the commissioner. I love that fact. So just across the board, I'm sitting there saying that the Miami Dolphins, they knew. They started playing the cards that were dealt to them, and they're sitting there saying, okay, we have a really good opportunity to get Rosen here. Second-round pick, I don't know if they knew it was going to be a second-round pick or whatever the case at that moment, but they're sitting there saying, we could go in a different direction, fill another need right here, and then come back, circle around, make a trade, which has worked out perfectly, I think, for the Miami Dolphins. It just has to now work on the football field and not just on paper.
You mentioned Wilkins. He is the third straight first-round defensive player for the Miami Dolphins. And you look at their nucleus now, Wilkins. We don't know how the Van Ginkle kid picking the fifth round is going to turn out, so we won't even consider him. But Minka, Jerome Baker, Charles Harris, Raekwon McMillan, Xavien Howard. When are all these seemingly talented young players going to have better than the 31st ranked defense or whatever it was in the league? I think they gave up the most yards ever in Dolphins history in 2018. Shouldn't we start seeing results if they're using all this draft capital on the defensive side of the football?
You have to start seeing results. You're drafting all of these defensive players. They come in, you know, first round, second round. So they're talented players on paper and everything. This is where I think the scheme, once again, comes into play with these young kids. And the Miami Dolphins, they have to put that together, put them in the right position. Because when you look at all of the young guys you're just talking about, just ball skills and knowledge of the football game, I think it looks pretty good moving forward. So all of a sudden, they get a little more experience here in the National Football League. They know the tricks of the trade, and they start to play better. I mean, you can look at the Cleveland Browns and some of the other – I can't believe I just sat here and said the Cleveland Browns. But you look at some of these teams, you know, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, when they were bad for a long time and then they started drafting defensive players, they had good play on the defensive side of the football. So I like that the Miami Dolphins are doing that because we sit here and we know it comes down to the quarterback, but the teams that are successful, they get after you defensively and they run the football. And I kind of like that the Miami Dolphins are setting those two things up.
Troy, you and I have been talking draft for a number of years now, and every year Troy talks about drafting a linebacker in the first round. We're still waiting on that, Troy. I'm not saying that they should have taken a linebacker at 13 based on the talent available, but we're still waiting for that.
We're still waiting for that. I know they drafted Van Ginkle, right?
Yes.
So he's that high, I guess that we could tag him that hybrid, versatile type of player that the New England Patriots, you know, had him stand up, put his hand on the ground sometimes, move him around. Maybe he's that type of player that the Miami Dolphins are looking for to fit into the system once again. Here I am with the whole system thing. But I really think that that's the direction that they went in, and they should. All teams should do that. This is what we're going to do. This is how we play, and we need to get the players. He might not be high on your board, but inside this building and inside what we're trying to do, we believe he fits that. And so Van Ginkle, he has a – and am I saying his name right? Is it Ginkle?
It is.
Van Ginkle.
Yes, you got it.
Van Ginkle. So he's that guy that, you know, arguably fits right into what the Miami Dolphins are going to do moving forward.
All right, Troy, I got to ask you, 254 players had their names called over the weekend, a bunch more signed as undrafted free agents, and with all that being said, I want to go back to 1987. What do you remember about your draft experience as a prospective draft pick waiting for your name to be called?
I was pissed. I kept sliding. Yeah, I'm thinking that it was a possibility that I was going to go in the second round. There was a rumor out there that the San Francisco 49ers were going to draft me in the first round. They ended up taking the running back out of Clemson, who ended up sucking, by the way. So they made a mistake in that sense. So I was really upset as the day went along. I can remember I was back home where I grew up, and I started slipping, and I actually went outside and started playing touch football with the kids in the neighborhood like I used to play growing up, and I had to get away from the television back in the day. It was all done on one day. And then once my name was finally called, you just get an opportunity to, like, exhale. And believe it or not, back then, the next day I was on a plane to come down here, and we had, like, 1 week of off-season workouts. So it was not much time to think about it. It was just, let's get to work. Let's try and learn what the Miami Dolphins are doing and just go out there and show people what you can do. So it was very uneasy on draft day, but after draft day, it was about, look, I'm better than this guy. I'm going to show I'm better than that guy. I'm coming down here to play football, and it kind of worked out that way.
Well, then along those lines, just to, I mean, I think people are aware of this to a certain degree, but to show how things have changed, now you've got, you know, pretty – I know you got the voluntary mini camp, all that stuff, and there's been some issues with the definition of the term voluntary and all that. But there's a lot of time that players spend at the facility during the offseason. I mean, you're talking about just a week, right? That you were there, and then the rest of your offseason as a rookie, you were just, what were you doing?
I went back home to New Jersey and I worked out. So I had 5 days of practice, and then I came back the next time I came back to Miami, it was just for training camp. So there was no other, they sent me home with the playbook. They say, here, learn this. I was like, okay. So I would study the playbook often back home, but it was just 1 week. And when I came back, you know, I had my little cheat sheet written on my wrist and things of that nature to remember certain plays, but it was just a matter of picking it up. And that's where it goes to. That's why I'm big on smart football players who could pick it up, because all of a sudden we come back, we start training camp, and honestly, there were guys that were drafted who didn't have a clue of what was going on, and I picked up rather quickly, so I think that was to my advantage, and I'm hoping that happens with the Miami Dolphins, and they have so much more work together down here these days. I'm just hoping that the smartness gets these guys on the football field a lot sooner.
Well, it was to your advantage. Troy Stratford joining us here because you won the Rookie of the Year on the offensive side of the ball. And as you've told me a number of times, but I don't think people get tired of hearing these stories. I mean, you quickly became a favorite of Dan Marino because of your ability to catch the ball out of the backfield or line up in the slot. So what was that relationship development like when you got down there and Marino was already an established star in the league?
I'll tell you this. It was the first week that I came down here. We had that 1 week of practice. It was the final two practices of that week. We were in the meeting, and we were going out to practice, and all of a sudden, the Shula and company, they came up with, they wanted, because they drafted a rookie quarterback also in that group with me, and I don't remember his name. And they said, well, we want to see the young quarterback work with the first unit. And I'm like, that don't make sense. So we go out to practice, and after the practice, so I'm looking at this, every pass play that was called that day in practice, and a lot of it was to me, Dan threw me the ball every single time. And that entire week of practice, every time the ball was thrown to me, I didn't have one drop the entire week. So that last day, that they're sitting, they wanted to see me work with Dan, if I could work with Dan. So Dan threw me every pass. I got a lot of plays the last day of practice, and I was successful that last day. And so it kind of worked out. I went back home, and they said, okay, we're going to work on working you in the slot on third down. And I said, okay, I could do that. So I had no problem with it. So it was all about that 1 week of practice that really opened the eyes for the Miami Dolphins coaching staff. And I really don't think that they thought that I was that good at that point, but it was just a matter of being a smart football player and just being talented and playing catch and not putting the ball on the ground.
So you're saying you don't remember the name of that quarterback that they had thrown the ball to? Yeah, that was the 12th round pick in 1987.
12th round, right?
Jim is either Carsados or Carsados. From Ohio
State? I couldn't even tell you his first name, where he was from. But all I know is this guy, what, they want to see him work with the first unit? No, they wanted to see if I could work with Dan. So they brought Dan. Because, see, I was not a first-round draft pick. If I was a first-round draft pick, they could have put me with the first unit and say, we want to see Troy work with the first unit. But they couldn't do that. That's the politics of the game. So they was like, okay, we can't throw Troy in there with the first unit. Well, let's let Dan work with the second and the third unit today. And I was like, okay, let's work with it. So it worked out.
It certainly did. Troy, just to wrap this up, and we appreciate your time, I have not spoken to you since the Masters, so I don't know if you want to say anything, because this is a bit of an inside joke.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, the floor is yours about what happened at the Masters.
Tiger's back. It was absolutely great to be glued to the television once again to watch golf. And be honest with you, without Tiger, I will tune in if I'm channel surfing or whatever the case may be, but I'm not glued or locked in. But when Tiger is challenging, you're sitting there, and you could just tell, just his body language, that he was so locked into that thing, and I enjoyed it. Oh, I actually watched the thing a second time because of the weather delay. They replayed it, and so I actually watched part of it the first time because it caught me off guard that it was on early. And then I ended up watching the replay, and I don't ever recall myself watching the replay of some golf tournament. So, yeah, Tiger had me locked in. And you know what I thought was funny? After, I don't know if people noticed this. When he was walking, after it was all over, and he was walking down with his son, who was on his right-hand side a little bit behind him, I don't know if you noticed his son's walk, how he swung his arms and everything. His son was walking like he was the boss. I enjoyed the whole thing from start to finish. Good to see him, right? Good to see him.
Well, I'm sure it was great to watch that. I can't relate. I was flying back from Aruba during the final eight, nine holes. I had scheduled the flight home thinking I'd be able to get home, drive to my house in time for the last 6-7 holes, and then Mother Nature made it a 9:30 start, and I was doomed. So flying over the Caribbean with spotty Wi-Fi, I was trying to follow along on Twitter, and it didn't feel very good inside to be missing history.
Yeah, that was just something great to watch. I'm sure the ratings were off the roof when it comes to the viewership on that particular day. And it was just nice to see Tiger, and you saw the excitement in him once it was all over. And honestly, I got chills, and I'm not gonna sit here and say that I cried a little bit, but I was feeling a little something inside for Tiger. Tiger's back, Vikings. Tiger is back.
I knew you wanted to say that, and then let everybody hear it out there. So, Troy, glad we got that in. Troy, thank you so much for joining the program. Appreciate it, as always. Great to catch up with you, and we'll talk again soon.
You got it, fellas. Have a good night.
All right. There he is, Troy Stratford, postgame analyst on the Miami Dolphins Radio Network, former Dolphins running back, the 1987 NFL Offensive Rookie of the Year. You can follow him on Twitter, at Troy Stratford. Nice enough to join us here on this Tuesday evening. All right, Bees, we got a lot more to get into. We'll come back, talk more about Josh Rosen, maybe a little bit about Christian Wilkins, too, because he has been overshadowed with all the quarterback conversation. We'll come back with much more next year on QA.